Hey, this is Simon Scriver.
And this is Nikki Bell.
We are running a virtual fundraising conference on November 19th. It's called Fundraising Everywhere, and you can find it at fundraisingeverywhere.com.
There's some amazing speakers that we've got lined up for you. We've got some names on there that you will be familiar with and some speakers that you may not have heard before, but all of them will be sharing amazing fundraising methods that are proven to work, and they will be teaching us how to do that in our own charities.
We've tried to make it really affordable for all organizations, but for small charities, it is completely free. So go look at it at fundraisingeverywhere.com. Register now. Join us. It will be accessible. It will be affordable, and it is amazing.
Yes.
You're listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar podcast, talking all things fundraising, charities, nonprofits, and more.
Yep, I'm still on vacation. So here's guest host Sarah Lyon.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Podcast. I am not Simon. Simon is still off doing some self-care on the beaches of Thailand. My self-care routine is usually catching up with Coronation Street, so obviously I'm doing self-care wrong. If you go to the library that Simon has of his podcast, he does have a quick tip on self-care for fundraisers. So after you listen to this podcast, please go over to the library and check that out and find a self-care routine for you, because it's important to all of us. Today's topic is diversity and inclusion. And I know that we hear that a lot, but I wanted to amplify, first of all, a female fundraiser's voice, because those need to be amplified. But I wanted to amplify a voice of Liz Chornenki. Liz and I met at the AFP Congress in November, and we met during the process for a track that was education sessions around tough topics. And what I loved is Liz is very open and very blunt and says it like it is and should be. And I wish there was more people like that. So when I knew that I was going to be guest hosting for Simon, I knew I wanted to talk to Liz. So Liz, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for doing this. And so Liz, you are from the YMCA Toronto. So
YWCA.
YWCA. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I'm trying not to move papers around. I apologize. You know what? With that, can you introduce yourself, please?
Yes. So I am a fundraiser at the YWCA of Toronto. I'm an annual giving officer, which means I get to hang out a lot in Razor's Edge and do a lot of direct mail. I am a graduate of the Humber fundraising program. I graduated in 2018, and I went there to sort of buff up my fundraising skills because I had been working in fundraising previously. And then had some struggles with finding a new job. So I decided to go back to school and relearn or learn some new and exciting things.
You just said something so amazing there. So I just want to go back to it. You okay. Wanted to stay in fundraising. So you filled out an application, paid an application fee to go to school to do fundraising. You love it that much.
Sure did.
So why? Why do you love fundraising?
Well, my original background is in social work. I have a BSW, and I knew I always wanted to work in those, you know, helping professions. But social work actually has a lot of ableism issues of its own that sort of inhibited me from working in that field. Just I couldn't get hired in those roles. And then I found myself in a fundraising position at my previous job, and I really, really enjoyed it. I started to follow fundraising Twitter and learn all of these neat things about fundraising. And it was a great way for me to use the skills that I have in relationship building and interpersonal communication in a different aspect of social service.
Amazing. So just to start off the podcast, you used a term in there. And just in case there is somebody who doesn't know the definition or what you define as ableism. I'm not even saying it right. Ableism.
Ableism, yes. Ableism. Ableism is essentially discrimination against disabled people, much in the way that there is sexism and other similar things. It's the view that disabled people are less worthy. We don't set up society for them. And it can be any type of disability that is affected by that. Even people who don't necessarily consider themselves disabled can still experience ableism based on medical conditions or various other things that they experience.
Okay, excellent. I think that we might come up to more terminology during our chat. So when I asked you to come onto the podcast, I said that I wanted to talk about inclusion because I find that we say diversity and inclusion a lot, and a lot of our blog posts that we might read or conference sessions we might go to me, really focused on diversity. And you said, you know, if you're going to talk inclusion, we also need to talk about diversity. So why?
Well, the thing is, specifically speaking for the disability community, we are an extremely diverse community. We cross every other intersection of privilege and oppression that exists in human society. And so when we're looking at disability and specifically inclusion and access, we tend to look to the white, straight, cisgendered, disabled people and ignore all of the multiply marginalized voices, especially Black disabled women and Black disabled trans folk. And to me, that's just the complete opposite of actual inclusion, is just taking me because I'm white, but ignoring someone else because they're a person of color.
Interesting. So one of the things I heard today, so Pride started today, okay, here in Nova Scotia, and there was somebody on the radio who said, you know, when they did a survey of what LGBTQ2S people wanted, it was, you know, public education. And the how she framed that was, if you're not comfortable walking down the street or going to a restaurant, you're not comfortable in bigger settings. And it got me thinking about today's podcast about, you know, going to an interview if mm-hmm. you're from a diverse and population, or going to Humber. So, yeah. You know, tell me about that experience for you.
So Humber was a real struggle for me. I've been fairly open about it ever since I was even in the program. I was the only visibly disabled person in our program. I don't necessarily know how anybody else identified, but I would sit through classes and they would be just so deeply upsetting as the disabled person in the room. We would watch fundraising videos for various charities that fundraised for people with disabilities, and they would just be deeply offensive. And we would learn different things. One of my pet peeves in life is open, appropriate body posture when talking to a person. That to me is a very ableist notion, because a lot of us can't control what our bodies do and don't do when we're communicating. And so I'm sitting in these classes day after day where it's just like, it was really painful. I spent a lot of time talking to my program director about it because I was deeply upset by it. I was really glad that I stayed in the program and kept going with what I was doing, because in between those bits of ableism, there were great pieces of information and there were opportunities for me to speak up and say, like, this is not okay. And actually, I started doing that probably by November of my year in Humber. I started being a lot more vocal about the things I was seeing and wanting to bring out to the entire fundraising community that these things are not okay. I've been involved in fundraising in some way my whole life. I've been the poster child for a children's hospital. I look back at that and I'm like, ooh, that is not something adult Liz would do as a disabled person, because I find some of the messaging around that really, really offensive and really ableist. But these aren't things that I really thought of until I was even in the program, in terms of philanthropy as a field having issues with disability and diversity and inclusion.
Wow. I think you hit on something there. I'm writing notes as you're saying it, because, yeah, you know, one of the things that I don't know that Humber taught this, but I'm thinking in any professional school, they try to prep you for the workforce. And so they would say those things about interviews and standing up to shake hands or, you know, things that able-bodied people, is that the right term?
Actually, it would just be abled, because that way it includes people with mental health and neurodiversity differences as well.
Thank you. Language, very important. So before this, Liz and I talked and I said, please let me know, because when you know better, you do better. But I'm just thinking from, you know, an employer's, because you've been in the industry for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So what advice do you, or what do you, not advice, what do you want employers in our industry to know about diversity and inclusion?
The first thing that comes to mind, and it came to mind a minute ago when you originally asked your question, was about the whole using cultural fit as a way to reject applicants. So many places say you're not a cultural fit. And what that generally means is you're not like everybody else we already have here. And so that just perpetuates the hiring of the exact same type of people across every area. And then you say, oh, we don't get any people of color. We don't get any disabled people here, because you're always talking about how the cultural fit has to be right. I think that's way too subjective of a thing to use as a hiring, a gauge of whether somebody should be hired. I think you need to look at what they bring to the job as a worker and then see if they fit. And you don't have to be best friends with your coworkers in order to fit in the office.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I am very good friends with several of my coworkers and I really love them, but I would be able to work in an environment where I was different from everyone on a variety of levels, which I already do. And cultural fit just isn't a part of what allows me to do that. What allows me to do that is that I am a good person and I do my work and I expect, you know, good things to happen. Those are the things that make me a valuable employee, not whether I fit in with what you already have.
That is so true. And we had this conversation at my own work when I said fit, or one of the other directors said, oh, that, you know, I don't think they're going to fit in. And somebody who was working diversity and inclusion portfolio for my work said, no, you can't, like, don't use that. And so I think that's really important. And thank you for saying that. I hope people are hearing you. I think one of the things too that we talked about is we don't see, and I know you can't see, and so this is how do you ask this question? We talk about diversity and inclusion. We don't necessarily see it in our industry.
Yes.
You know, so we talked about this because at a conference we were at, you couldn't get to the front of the room.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so that wasn't taken into account because there might only be one or two. And I know I've seen this on Twitter at other conferences. So what would be a takeaway that you would want conference organizers to know from your lived experience, from your advocacy? You know, I realize too, again, that there's an emotional labor I'm putting on by asking these questions. So thank you very much for speaking and open and honest and blunt like you are. So thank you. But
I think the thing that conference organizers need to know is expect disabled people to be there. We shouldn't have to RSVP with our access needs. You should be providing access. You should be asking proactively from your registrants, what do you need? What can we do to make this better? There should be things like captioning or interpretation or, you know, open seating plans. They should just exist so that when we show up, they're there. Yeah. Access on demand is not access.
Ooh, I like that. That's
one of my biggest pet peeves.
Yeah, and it's such an easy thing to remember when you're planning, like just using that line.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good takeaway. Thank you. You know, what made you say yes to doing this podcast? And I say that because I have read on Twitter, you know, when you said, I'm tired, guys. Why do I have to keep saying this? So what made you say yes to talking about this to a large and international fundraising crew?
I think what it was is that, okay, I am passionate enough about fundraising to believe that we can change and that we can do better. And I feel like if I'm not starting the conversations right now, no one is. And that's kind of what I mean when I say that I'm tired of talking about it. I'm tired of being the only person who starts the conversations. I would love if my able-bodied peers and colleagues went and just said, hey, this isn't okay. Why don't we try this? Or this is offensive. This language is inappropriate. Why don't we change this? Rather than waiting until I see it, like I've seen campaigns out in the world that have this truly deeply ableist bent to them because no one's asking disabled people for their opinions on it before it happens. And no abled person is looking at it and going, yes, that's a problem.
So what, you know, and you said it just there, and you said it before about the fact that you were on a campaign for a hospital, you know, what could your fellow fundraisers who are on the ground, who are working on campaigns, who are, you know, doing the marketing and the communications, like what are some things that you want them to know?
The first thing that you have to know is that there is no one disabled voice. There is a disabled community, and we do share a lot of our views on language and communication and portrayal of disability as a negative, things like that. But if you've spoken to one disabled person, you've spoken to one disabled person.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of why I try not to put myself out there as the spokesperson for disabled fundraising. Because I am a white cis woman.
Mm-hmm.
So there are still many things that I have no lived experience about and no understanding about that you have to go to other people for. But oftentimes people will pick me and go, oh, Liz can answer these questions. Liz can fix this problem. And I'm like, no, man, I can't do this for everything. I can only do this from my personal perspective. So you need to seek out diverse voices within the disability community before you let any campaign go out.
Mm-hmm.
And that works for pretty much every agency. Mm-hmm. International development, medicine, social services. You need to look to the communities that you're representing with your campaign and say, hey, is this a good way to portray you? Is this language the way that you like to be portrayed? And if it's not, you need to be willing to step back and change it rather than just taking their feedback and ignoring it, which happens in lots of contexts.
Yeah, we talk about being donor-centered, but we need to be people-centered.
Yes. And especially because I'm a disabled person and I'm also a donor to multiple charities.
Mm-hmm.
So if I see a charity that's putting out an ableist campaign, I will not give them my money. So you're missing out on a segment not only of fundraisers and beneficiaries, but also of donors. We're never looked at as prospective donors unless we also happen to be old and disabled due to age. Then people are oddly willing to look past that from a donor perspective and say, oh, they might still be a potential donor. But myself as a young disabled woman, I'm not considered a donor for most people.
It's an interesting flip on it because what we're saying is a disabled, you know, there's having diversity and inclusion in the fundraising profession, but then, you know, flipping it to say this is also donors. I think that's a good way to look at it. And why? Why aren't we?
I don't know why we aren't. I think we get hung up in the donor archetype that, I mean, we all know we have one in our organization or in our education where we're like, this is Dorothy Donor. She's 96. She's white. She has grandchildren. And that's what we cater to, never considering that, yes, that might be 20% of our donor base, but the remaining 80% of our donor base could make up just a vast array of people. But we don't, we get hung up on, this is Dorothy Donor. She has the money. Let's talk to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just because we're so, I know some people won't like to hear this, but as a profession, we're very averse to change a lot of times.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff that I have learned is not new. It is not current. It doesn't reflect the general diversity of the population in Canada. Because we're so resistant to change and we look at the groups of people who have generational wealth, which do tend to be the white, able-bodied, cis, straight people, and we ignore everyone else up to the point where maybe I can't give you a $5,000 gift, but I make a great monthly donor at $20 a month.
Yeah.
And we need to start being willing to consider people outside of our archetype and find out ways to reach them by working with those communities.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. You're wrapping, you're saying it all. I mean, I have nothing to, nothing to really add. Like, I'm trying to think of how to, that was just a perfect way to put it. I guess the question is, you know, so if we're not seeing people who are diverse and we're not including those voices, we know that's a problem, you know, what can we do as an industry? So yes, when we're doing campaigns, be person-centered, go to that community, ask people, you know, be open to who can work in an organization, be open to who can donate. But I think that we talk about it a lot and there's no tools or resources for us in the fundraising world. You know, there's the fellows here in Canada, the fellows program, the inclusivity program that fellows have gone through, which has, you know, there's a great website out there for people to learn about giving through different cultures.
The question I want to counter that with is, okay, how many people know that the diversity and inclusion website actually exists from AFP? There are papers and projects written by tons of brilliant, diverse people on this website. And I feel like for the most part, they're just there. We're not promoting them and sharing these voices amongst the loud voices in fundraising.
Well, exactly. I completely agree with you. So we're telling them now. Mm-hmm. So all the listeners, after you finish this podcast, you should check it out. And if Simon can, he might put it into the notes. But that's my question, you know, is that that points to a fundamental problem just within our industry?
I mean, it points to a fundamental problem within our society, but as our industry happens, because we've been focused so long for, you know, the entire duration of philanthropy has been about helping those who can't help themselves. By the way, I hate that phrase.
Right.
So we look upon poor people, disabled people, people of color, trans people, we look at them as recipients of service. Mm-hmm. We don't look at them outside of that. And we have a really hard time accepting that an organization that runs for disabled people should be run by disabled people. And that's, I think, one of people's major sticking points is they don't want to give up their power. But until the majority of people are willing to give up their power for those that are marginalized by the way that society treats them and the systems put in place, then there can be no change. We can't make change from the bottom. We can make change from the top, but you have to let us in there.
Yeah, that whole notion that we kind of say that people have, like, especially those that we are there to support, have a single story, and it's not true.
Yeah. No group, no person, no community has a single story, nor are they one-dimensional people who are only ever in need of service.
Yeah.
I think that's something that really gets to me is when I see, specifically from an ableism perspective, it's when I see the pitying, the sad, disabled person, often with, you know, flies or some sort of visual signal that they are left out and unwanted. Mm-hmm. That's not reflecting who I am.
Mm-hmm.
It's keeping that person as only needing help. I am always happy to acknowledge that I need help in things. I think the whole notion of independence doesn't exist. Everyone right. needs help with something, but I don't like being stuck as only ever needing help and never being capable of giving help or doing some sort of major change in the world. That to me is what stops a lot of people mentally from being willing to accept other people in positions of leadership.
So I like what you said about, you know, do we have organizations for people in communities run by the people from those communities? And I would say the same about, it's not about mentorship. It's about sponsoring people from those communities with diverse voices to get a position on a board, right?
Yes.
To say that I'm an ally. Right. That is that one way that we in fundraising, you know, that can be, how can we be an ally as fundraisers?
Okay. I'm going to call you out on one thing before I answer your question.
Yes, and please, that is
that I don't feel that allies exist. Allyship is a process, an ongoing action that you do. You perform allyship. Being an ally doesn't really mean anything. What you do with that power that you have is what makes a difference. So I don't believe that there are allies. I believe there are people that are working towards allyship with marginalized communities. But in terms of sponsorship and mentorship, I think that's really an important thing to have. I tried to get matched up with a mentor who was disabled while I was in Humber, and there just wasn't anyone that existed.
Mm-hmm.
There was no one that had graduated from the program that was still, you know, in fundraising and working down here and all of those things that was disabled. And so I had no one to open doors for me. Mm-hmm. And then I met my friend Jim, Gingerheaded Dad on Twitter.
Hi, Jim.
Who wants to bother him? I met him through social media, found out that he was a fundraiser. And he has become that sponsor for me. He's the person that wrote a presentation with me last year and helped me present it at Accelerate Day. But he's also taken a distinct step back from that presentation now and is letting me take the lead on all of this stuff because he knows I'm the person with lived experience. He was there to get me in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done such an amazing job of it, but I don't know very many other people that do that. I don't know very many people that are willing to take a person, specifically a disabled person, and help them through listening to their lived experiences rather than trying to tell me how to do this career from an abled perspective. Because I'm never going to be able to do anything from an abled perspective. That's not who I am. So if I'm telling you that it's, you know, there's an attitudinal barrier to me getting jobs, telling me to, you know, write a better resume, be more cheerful, those things aren't going to make a difference. You would have to go out of your way, use your voice, use your power and say, this is Liz. She would be amazing at this job. You should interview her.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of labor that you have to do if you're going to want to work towards allyship with specifically the disability community. You have to be willing to put your name out there attached to the name of somebody who is working to get into the fundraising profession as a disabled person, because your name, your voice, and your opinion holds so much more weight than ours does.
Until we can make that shift.
Yes. One day.
That's I'm learning so much, and I hope everybody who is listening is learning so much. So I want to thank you. We did a pre-chat for about half an hour before we started chatting. So I know we can talk forever about this. And so I want to say thank you for coming on and speaking up and out and being your true, authentic, blunt self, which I love. And if people want to hear from you, how can they get a hold of you, or are you presenting somewhere soon?
Yeah, so I'm presenting at AFP Congress in November. I am part of a panel on disability, ableism, and fundraising. I would love if people came out to see that and participate in it. I want to hear, you know, everyone's experiences. The best place to find me is always on Twitter, and I am at LizBeth_city. Hopefully Simon can put that somewhere. And that is where you will find all of my unfiltered opinions on pretty much everything.
All right. So this will be the last question. Okay. What do you do for self-care as a fundraiser?
Honestly, a huge part of my self-care is talking to other people. I am fairly classic extrovert most of the time, and I function best when I'm able to put my stress out on the table and talk about it with someone who understands. So another fundraiser, another disabled person, it really depends on the conversation, and just making those connections allows me to offload some of the stress and frustration.
Excellent. Well, thank you for talking to me today. And to all of us who are listening, thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent.
You've been listening to Simon Scriver's Amazingly Ultimate Fundraising Superstar Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and head over to changefundraising.com to learn more or get in touch with Simon. Or don't. Whatever. You're big enough to make your own decisions.
Hey, this is Simon Scriver.
And this is Nikki Bell.
We are running a virtual fundraising conference on November 19th. It's called Fundraising Everywhere, and you can find it at fundraisingeverywhere.com.
There's some amazing speakers that we've got lined up for you. We've got some names on there that you will be familiar with and some speakers that you may not have heard before, but all of them will be sharing amazing fundraising methods that are proven to work, and they will be teaching us how to do that in our own charities.
We've tried to make it really affordable for all organizations, but for small charities, it is completely free. So go look at it at fundraisingeverywhere.com. Register now. Join us. It will be accessible. It will be affordable, and it is amazing.
Yes.